It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up later in the show, we'll look at the role that one anonymous online message board has had in recent mass shootings and what internet providers and law enforcement can do about it. First, when things go wrong in the course of a day, maybe spilling the coffee you just bought or running into a traffic jam, it's easy to blow things out of proportion. We might tell ourselves that the rest of the day is ruined and things will keep going downhill from there. Our next guest calls that thought process catastrophizing and says it's worth learning how to avoid it and turning our focus back to things that really matter. Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology and the associate dean for the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's probably safe to say that we've all thought this way, fallen into this pattern at one time or another. Why is catastrophizing so easy and so common?
Yeah, so a great question. It is really easy and it is really common. And it plays into just a way of thinking, especially when people are stressed, that they find themselves essentially something goes wrong and they find themselves really just kind of thinking through how it's going to ruin their day, how it's going to ruin their week, how it's going to ruin their career or whatever.
And what's so bad about doing it?
Yeah, so it's associated with actually all sorts of emotional problems. But the two biggies are anxiety, and then in the case that I tend to write about is anger. That when things happen to us and we evaluate those events in highly negative ways, we're more likely to get angry about them. We're more likely to get scared.
So what is the opposite of catastrophizing? What's the better goal?
Yeah, I think what I usually encourage people to do is when they encounter events in their lives that they perceive as negative, to really think through the true consequences of the event to the best that they can. So think through, what does this outcome mean? I hit a stoplight. I was hoping to get through it. Does this ruin my day? How bad is this going to be? And part of what you do there is actually think through, okay, so how long a delay is this? Probably 3 minutes. What does that mean in the grand scheme of my day? Chances are, once people have a chance to really sit down and evaluate that thought process, they see that it's not quite as bad as they originally thought it would be.
And is saying that it would be a good technique to trying to avoid to catastrophize things, does that mean that we should never get upset about things that happen in every day?
No, not at all. In fact, I sometimes, and maybe too often, see the opposite of that, which is someone describing something really upsetting, really disappointing, and then following up with, but it's fine, you know, and it's not fine, and it's okay to say it's not fine. I think the healthiest option is to try and really think through as logically as you can, what is the real consequence of this? And it's okay to be disappointed when things are disappointing. It's okay to be scared if something negative happens or to be angry when something negative happens. In fact, it's healthy to feel that way. It's just the question is really about evaluating what am I responding to and how bad is this?
So it sounds kind of like putting it into perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because I don't want to suggest to people that there aren't such things as catastrophes. There are, and there are things that do ruin your day or ruin your trip or whatever. It's just about trying to think through those, think about them in the context of your life, think about them in the context of kind of other people's lives, and to try and kind of grab hold onto what does this really mean, instead of thinking about that initial gut response, which is oftentimes, well, this is terrible. This is the worst thing ever.
We're talking with Ryan Martin right now. He's a professor of psychology and the associate dean for the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. And we're talking about our very human tendency to catastrophize things, to make them seem or feel like they are much bigger deals than they are. And I wanted to go back to something that you said, Ryan. It sounded like you were saying that we might have a tendency also to kind of think of it as the last straw. So if a few other things have gone badly or not the way we wanted them to in the last day, week, month, whatever, it's like, oh, great. Now this is happening. And we kind of, it's almost like we're putting all that frustration into the most recent event.
Yeah. So when people get angry, when you look at the situations in which people are likely to get mad, there's really two parts of the what we call the appraisal process. And the appraisal process is how we evaluate the provocation, the thing that went wrong. And the first part is actually pretty simple. It's when you evaluate the culprit, we'll say, you know, and it's when you say, okay, this is bad, this is negative, this is unfair, that sort of thing. But then, and that's primary appraisal, but the second part is really where catastrophizing comes in, and it's where you evaluate whether or not you can cope with this thing. So this is where you're really asking yourself, can I deal with this? Because if your interpretation is, yeah, this is bad, but it's not that big a deal, I got plenty of time, I'm not going to be too late, you're probably going to be fine. If your evaluation is, yeah, this is bad, and it's going to ruin my entire day, well, then you're more likely to get angry.
So we had some comments on Facebook. One is from Joel, and he says, don't sweat the small stuff, and 99.9% of everything is small stuff and won't matter a month from now. Is thinking ahead to the future, and as we said before, putting things in a little more context and perspective, a good approach?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that it makes sense to really think about things from that sort of, eagle eye or bird's eye perspective. How big a deal is this? Will I in the future be thinking back on this problem? And chances are you won't. And that certainly makes sense. I think, too, I mean, there's other approaches. You mentioned putting into perspective, which is related, but you can think about things in terms of other problems human beings face. And you can think about, like, okay, so, you know, my computer isn't working properly, but it obviously could be so much worse than that. Those are other ways that, people can deal with those frustrations.
Besides looking forward, it also seems like looking back in some ways could be helpful. For instance, if you've dealt with a similar situation, I'm thinking maybe something at work or maybe something, you know, with your family where it's not the first time that that's happened. You've dealt with it in the past. And yes, maybe it was an annoyance or a minor setback, but here you are today, you know, to tell the tale. So looking back and thinking, yeah, you know, this isn't ideal, but I've dealt with it before. Can that help too?
Absolutely. I think that's an approach a lot of people can take, which is that sort of this too shall pass approach. I've dealt with this kind of problem before, and I'll probably deal with it again. I think the other benefit of thinking about past events is that it gives you the opportunity to acknowledge patterns that are emerging and then start to solve problems if you can. You know, if you own part of that pattern in some way, so maybe I'm consistently running into traffic on my way to work and it's making me frustrated, well, maybe I need to think about things like another route or leaving a little earlier or a host of other options, or just accepting this is how long it takes and I may want it to go faster, but I'm just going to have to, you know, choose better music.
or a great podcast or listen to public radio, right? We're talking with UW Green Bay psychology professor Ryan Martin about our tendency to make things a bigger deal than they are, also known as catastrophizing. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself blowing small things out of proportion? What effect does it have on your mood in the moment, that day, or maybe for even longer? If you're able to avoid catastrophizing, how do you do it? What advice would you give to others on how to keep things in perspective? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about anger and catastrophizing with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself getting angrier than you should about everyday things that go wrong? What have you tried in order to keep things in perspective? And what advice do you have for people about responding to things when they go wrong? What questions do you have for our guest about anger? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's go to the phones. And Justin in Appleton is up. Hi, Justin.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Good. What would you like to share?
I would like to talk about how the state of health of an individual has a lot to do with their tolerance on any sort of situations that they might perceive as negative. Now, for myself, for instance, I could tell you that since I started the ketogenic diet and intermittent fasting, my tolerance for negative situations have gone way up. So I've been catastrophizing things a lot less. And I would like everyone to maybe take a look at their own health and make sure that they're getting the recommended daily requirements of an optimal nutrition.
All right. Thanks for that, Justin. And that's an interesting point, I think, Ryan, that, you know, how we are feeling in general, our health, our mental health, our physical health can certainly impact how we're able to respond to things.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And there's, you know, when you think about the equation that leads to why people get angry, there are other pieces than the ones we've talked about so far. And one of those is what's called the pre-anger state. And that is the mood you are in before the provocation. And it can include, nutrition and things like that. It can also include, are you stressed? Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you too hot or too cold? I mean, there's a billion factors there that can play a role and make it harder for you to tolerate those everyday annoyances.
Thanks for that call, Justin. And I was thinking, kind of going a little bit back to what Justin was saying, you know, we talk a lot about resilience and how much kind of elasticity we have in our emotions and in our ability to respond to things. If we are catastrophizing, does that lessen how resilient we can be? Because we're always kind of in that really high level of frustration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that related to resilience is this notion of frustration tolerance. You know, how much of a problem or how much frustration can you handle or tolerate? And, I think there are individual differences in that domain, with some people just not able to tolerate as much. But it's also, and I think related to what the caller said, there are times when we're able to tolerate more than at other times, the same people, right? And so, give the example, I slept poorly last night, so I've been pretty exhausted today. That means that some of those little frustrations that I encounter along the day might hit me a little harder than they would have if I'd gotten a full night's sleep.
And on Facebook, Deb said, most things can be treated calmly, but when I have an emotional tie to the situation, it makes letting it go pretty hard. Is it a good idea to evaluate, Mark, how close we might be to the events at hand, what it might be reminding us of, losing someone close to us versus that traffic jam you talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I usually want for people when it comes to dealing with anger is, you know, first and foremost, to kind of be as insightful as they can be about why they're feeling what they're feeling. And sometimes that's a very easy explanation. You know, it's a thing that would make anyone angry. Sometimes it's a little more complicated, and sometimes it is tied to some past experiences we've had. That people just have a history of having been sort of bossed around, so they don't like being told what to do, and that's a particular issue for them. Or the emotional connection to people involved might change things. All of those are going to be driving factors, and human beings are really, really complicated, and all of those are going to be factors. I think regardless of that, where that's coming from, it makes sense to try and pay attention to that, and part of that is evaluating the thoughts you're having in the moment.
We're talking with Ryan Martin right now. He's professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. And we're talking about the human tendency to catastrophize when things go wrong. And let's go to the phones. And Joan in Cresco, Iowa is up. Hi, Joan.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank the professor for putting a name to this syndrome. I wanted to say I'm in a retirement age, but a young retirement age, and I wanted to comment that I have an awful lot of friends who the catastrophe doesn't even happen, but they're overthinking or anxious about it before we ever do something. So whether it's taking a trip or traveling or going for a day outing, they're already thinking, well, it's going to be too hot or the car might break down, and I just have to laugh. So I came up with a saying. I had read somewhere a comment that said, life is messy and divine. And then I realized for most of us, about 75% of it's messy and about 25% of it's divine. So I added a corollary for all of them. I said, find the joy in the messiness.
That's great, Joan. And Mark, I'm guessing that, or Ryan, sorry, I'm guessing that you would not disagree that actually catastrophizing, how would we say that, catastrophizing in advance just in case is not a great approach.
Yeah, no, that is really interesting. I was thinking of it as anticipatory catastrophizing.
Yes.
But that is really interesting. And it's there is a related concept that people have written about called misestimating probabilities. And it's where you actually kind of assume the worst is going to happen. And so that by the time you get there, you've already kind of worked yourself up about it and gotten angry about it.
Yeah.
And it happens. And, you know, people, provocations or these negative events don't have to happen to us for us to get angry about them. We can get angry over imagined events. We can get angry over events from the past.
Joan, I think you sound like a wonderful person to go on vacation with, just for the record. So, Ryan, and another thought process tied to anger is overgeneralizing. How does that play into catastrophizing?
Yeah, a lot of times these and a handful of other thought types kind of play a role together. And so overgeneralizing is when we use these really kind of broad language when it comes to evaluating events. So you get stopped by a stoplight. Again, I know I keep using that example, but you say things like, oh, this always happens to me, or this happens every time, or something like that. And you basically, you take a single event and you turn it into a pattern. And once we do that, we stop responding to that specific event. We start responding to the pattern, which makes it feel much, much worse, right? If my spouse leaves the milk out and I'm frustrated by that, which makes sense, right? I wish it hadn't been left out. That's fine. But if I say, oh, she always does this, then now I'm responding to that pattern and making it a much bigger thing than it actually is.
Let's make sure we don't let you go without getting some really concrete advice on how we can start practicing not catastrophizing things. The next time that something happens and we're like, oh, that's, you know, that just ruined my day, or that's going to ruin my day if it happens. What's a good way to interrupt that thought process?
So I think the first thing is to, once you realize you're doing it, identify that catastrophic thought and then try and replace it with a more realistic one. So ask yourself, is this the worst thing that's ever happened, or is this a mild frustration, right? So instead of saying this weather has ruined my day, you can say, I'm disappointed, but I'm still going to do my best to have a good day. And then, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, please go ahead.
I was going to say, the second part is really to be patient with yourself and know that this takes time, right? So you've spent a lifetime developing these kind of thought habits, and it's going to take some time to undo them. And so the goal is that you're able to do that as closely to the event as possible.
On the other hand, you were saying that it's not particularly helpful if something does go wrong and it does have an impact to follow it up with, but it's okay, or but it's fine. Is there a way to allow ourselves to be kind of appropriately upset, keeping it in perspective, but, you know, giving ourselves that outlet when it makes sense?
Absolutely. I think that for many people, it's really important to acknowledge that there is something to be angry about, that there is something to be scared about. And then I think the next step is really deciding what you can do with that anger or that fear that might be productive. So is this a problem you can help solve or that you can solve on your own? If so, then work towards solving that. I think there is an art to figuring out at what point maybe you aren't able to contribute to the solution or you aren't able to help anymore and being able to let things go at that point.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Ryan, because it can be easy to feel pretty intense anger over things that we really don't have a lot of control over. It can happen with the news or politics. It can happen with planes always being delayed, a bunch of things that we really have almost no input or control of. Is there a balance of being realistic about those things, but not letting them take such a toll on us?
Yeah, there is. And it's awfully hard for people to myself included, to be able to find that balance and to acknowledge that, you know, there are things I can do about the state of politics in the world. There are things I can do about these kind of everyday problems I experience. Sometimes what I can do about them is limited because there's only one of me. But it's finding a way to try and change the things I can change, but also acknowledge that at a certain point my reach or my power ends, and I do need to accept some things. Accept them doesn't mean say, okay, it's not a big deal. It means just find ways to let those things go.
Is there any room for humor in dealing with things when they go wrong?
Yeah. So psychologists talk about there being what we call incompatible mood states. So the idea is that you can't be anxious and relaxed at the same time, or you can't be angry and relaxed at the same time. The same goes in some ways, depending on the type of humor, for anger and humor, that you can't really be angry and sort of find things light at the same time. Now, that depends on the type of humor, because things like sarcasm tend to be a little more hostile and aggressive. But if we can find ways to make things sound or feel funny to us, it's a way of alleviating some of that tension.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. He was with us to talk about the dangers of catastrophizing and how we can keep things in perspective. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the role that one anonymous online message board has played in recent mass shootings. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, some parents are exploiting a loophole in the college financial aid system by giving up custody of their teenagers. We'll talk with a reporter investigating the issue about how it works and how schools are responding. First, two mass shootings over the weekend in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, have claimed the lives of 31 individuals. Much of the country is in mourning today as we once again try and make sense out of what happened. One factor that some are looking to is the internet, and more specifically, an anonymous message board where the man accused of carrying out the El Paso shooting posted a racist manifesto. The website 8chan has also been linked to other mass shootings as well, and our next guest says the website is becoming a familiar detail in cases of white supremacist violence. April Glazier is a technology writer for Slate and has been reporting on the latest 8chan news. April, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First off, can you describe what 8chan is?
Sure. So 8chan is a message board of sorts. It was created in 2013 off of its original site or in response to 4chan, which is very similar to 8chan. And it is a place that has no moderation policies, essentially no moderation policies. So unlike Facebook or Twitter, where you can get kicked off or removed or your posts removed for saying things that are hateful or encouraging violence, that does not happen on 8chan. And that has allowed for violence to stew and for communities that encourage kind of hate like white supremacy and neo-Nazism to really incubate there. And I'll just say that 4chan, which many people might have heard of as well, actually does have some moderation policies that disallows things like doxing, which is the posting of people's personal information on the site. 8chan does not have those same requirements, and therefore the worst of the worst ends up there.
Well, and moderation is one thing, but even without moderation, someone obviously started these websites. What do we know about their origins?
Sure. So, I mean, I'm saying these sites don't have moderation on them, which allows for people to post whatever they want. 4chan started in 2003. 8chan started in 2013 when 4chan started doing some level of moderation. 8chan is run now out of the Philippines, but it was started in the United States. The person who founded it recently told yesterday to the New York Times and the Washington Post that the site should be shut down. And the site has become a forum for hate in really specific ways. I mean, not just the place that provides community or that allows for, the coordination of harassment campaigns, which is all terrible. But now we've seen, particularly after the Christchurch massacre that happened in New Zealand where 50 people were shot, that shooter posted a manifesto to 8chan prior to committing his horrific act of violence. And in that manifesto, he also posted a link and instructed his community to watch the live broadcast of his violence, which was, of course, then somehow performative, and then to disseminate that. And the violence was disseminated. Facebook removed 1.5 million copies of that video of the massacre within 24 hours of that happening. Then we saw the formula carried out again ahead of the Poway shooting in Southern California before a man shot up a synagogue and killed a person. He posted a manifesto to 8chan. And then we saw it again this weekend in El Paso, the same formula. A man, before he shot up the shopping center in El Paso targeting Latinos, put a manifesto on 8chan citing and saying that his inspiration was the Christchurch shooter. So this is becoming a playbook.
April Glazer is a technology writer for Slate and has been reporting on the latest 8chan news. She is with us now in the wake of the El Paso shooting, which, as she said, the website was used to promote that violence. There are certainly plenty of bad places on the internet, April. How specifically has this website become a digital gathering place for these extremists?
Sure, there are bad places on the internet, and there have long been places like Stormfront, which is a website specifically for members of the KKK and white supremacists. But 8chan is a place that is not specifically for a hate group, but has become a place that has become safe for hate groups, and as such, it's become a really useful recruiting ground for these communities. So people might go to 8chan just to revel in an offensive joke, to make fun of PC people, as they say, politically correct people. They might come to talk about violent video games that they enjoy, to discuss or make jokes about things that would cause offense to other people. And that's become kind of a way of indoctrinating and snowballing hate. And so once once people in these communities start laughing about something like the Holocaust or genocide, it's opened the doors for this to actually become an ideology that people actually start to believe in, and the irony goes away, and it actually becomes the way people think. And so this has become a place where people have become indoctrinated. They stumble on 8chan for different reasons, and then through various techniques of people who use the site, they've been actually encouraging people to adopt these ideologies and then encouraging them to enact violence.
There's apparently very extreme rhetoric, as you were saying, on the website. How has it not been shut down before?
Well, the website, like all websites, it operates, and it doesn't have moderation policies, and there are not like global rules for what can and cannot be on the internet worldwide. And in the United States in particular, websites have protection from being liable for what users post on those sites. So, even if you post something incredibly hateful or racist or violent to Facebook, Facebook can't be sued for that. That's from the Communications Decency Act, a mid-90s law. But with that liability, it's protected websites, like 8chan. But even more than that, since there's not moderation happening on 8chan, what we're seeing instead is the moderation kind of going up the stack. So since the owners of 8chan are not moderating what people can say, those who provide web services that allow 8chan to continue to exist, like Cloudflare, its previous security provider, are saying that they don't want to work with HCN anymore and are dropping it. So instead, we're seeing the moderation kind of move up the stack into the services like the domain registrars, cloud hosting, security companies that that kind of allow a website to even exist on the internet.
Well, and you refer to the company Cloudflare as one of the backbones of the internet, and it is taking some strides to try and take 8chan offline. What's the latest on that?
Well, with Cloudflare, they decided that they will no longer work with 8chan to provide security services. And this, of course, is coming after now three shootings tied to stuff posted on 8chan. And after Cloudflare dropped 8chan as a client, 8chan found another security service called Bitmitigate. Bitmitigate, it was reported this morning, actually lost its cloud hosting as a result of taking 8chan on as a client, presumably. And now 8chan is offline again. And, you know, we saw this happen with the Daily Stormer after the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. That was the website where that rally was planned. It's a neo-Nazi website. It lost its cloud hosting, its domain registrar, its security from Cloudflare, and for a time was offline and much harder to find. And when these sites go offline, when these infrastructure services, these web companies decide they don't want to work with these sites, then it's harder for their ideologies to spread, and it's harder for these communities to gather. So this type of, you know, non-service actually does have an effect on stopping to spread the type of odious ideologies that that are incubated on these sites.
And just to be clear, when you talk about security services, this is basically protecting a website from, say, being hacked and being taken down.
When we say hack, yeah, particularly Cloudflare provides security or protection from what's called a DDoS, or distributed denial of service attack, which is when a website is bombarded with so much traffic that it cannot handle the load and it breaks down.
And so you kind of just addressed this, but some have said that a permanent shutdown of 8chan, or deplatforming as it's known, would just cause hate groups to organize elsewhere. But it sounds like you're saying that lacking this place for them to come together, and as you said, people from across the globe coming together on these sites, that perhaps could have an impact on this white supremacist movement.
Well, it absolutely destabilizes them. I mean, the truth is that the internet is a pretty consolidated place, right? And there are a lot of core there's only a handful of core services or companies that are really big that provide this kind of domain registrar, these security services, these kinds of like internet backbone services. And so when those, you know, companies decide to come together and not provide web services for a certain website, it's going to be a lot harder for that website to get the infrastructure it needs to be online. And once that website is offline for some time, of course it destabilizes those communities. It might not be permanent because, you know, the internet is like people can create new websites, a thousand flowers can bloom.
And we'll have to leave it there. April, thank you so much for joining us. April Glazer is a technology writer for Slate. She joined us to discuss the website 8chan, where mass shooters have posted their hate-filled diatribes. Coming up, we'll find out how some families are giving up custody of their kids to take advantage of the financial aid system. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, 11 young people across Wisconsin have been hospitalized with severe lung disease, and officials say the common link is vaping. We'll talk to a public health expert from the State Department of Health Services about the latest on the investigation into what's happening. First, new reporting by ProPublica Illinois has found that dozens of families are exploiting a loophole in the financial aid program for college students. Parents in the Chicago suburbs are giving up custody of their kids so they can qualify for need-based aid before they start college classes. The students exploiting the system have enrolled at both private colleges and large state schools, including the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The practice is now getting attention from the U.S. Department of Education. Dua Eldeeb is a reporter for ProPublica Illinois. She's been one of the journalists investigating this story. Dua, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
First, can you explain for us how need-based financial aid works?
Yes. So basically, the way that it works is, you know, colleges look at the students' or the families' assets and their income levels, and based on that, they're able to determine how much financial aid they give the student.
And so the totals that financial aid officers are looking at, what income is being considered when they decide whether a student might need help paying for college?
They're looking at the parents' incomes and the parents' assets, because the students are, you know, the children of these of their parents. And so what happened in this case is the families were able to transfer guardianship of their children and then give it to another family member, a grandmother, an aunt, uncle, or even in some cases a close friend. And then when the student turned 18, they were able to declare themselves, independent. And then when the colleges and the public institutions went to look at their assets and incomes, it was based on the student's asset and incomes, not their families.
So this is a legal process, right, to basically give up custody of your child?
It's a legal process, and it's been around for a long time. And, you know, when we were looking at the court records, because this all happens in court, you can see the petitions for guardianship, and a lot of them are really difficult to read. They're about, parents who had to give up guardianship of their children because, you know, a family member, a parent was incarcerated or deported or had drugs or mental health issues and they weren't able to care for their children. And so that's typically how guardianship works, and it's usually done at a younger age. But then these petitions really stood out to us because, you know, those petitions, you know, the typical ones are usually handwritten by a family, again, who's really in dire straits. These were, you know, usually done by, they were typed up, they were done by lawyers, and they're saying, you know, we're doing this in, you know, because it's, we believe it's in the best interest of our child, and, you know, the guardian can provide educational and other opportunities that we can't provide.
And those opportunities are basically a smaller amount of income that would show up on that financial aid application.
Exactly. So basically, these families were earning too much to qualify for the need-based financial aid. So, for example, at the federal level, you have Pell Grants. In Illinois, we have MAP grants at the state level. And even the universities as well have some kind of specific need-based financial aid. And so when they were able then to use their income, the students' income levels and not the families' income levels, they were able to qualify for that need-based financial aid.
And what do we know about the families that were taking advantage of this loophole? What socioeconomic classes were they coming from primarily?
So from the ones we've looked at, and, you know, I'd like to just clarify by saying we've looked primarily at Lake County, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Includes a number of suburbs of Chicago. Some of them are fairly affluent. And some of these families are doctors, there's a lawyer, one of them is a school administrator. And so as far as we can tell, you know, again, these are not families who qualify for financial aid. But what the lawyer has said, one of the lawyers that handled these petitions for a number of families has said is, look, college is really expensive, and some of these families were struggling to pay for it, and this was the way that they figured out to get around it. And it is legal. The law does not preclude them from doing this.
We're talking with Dua Eldeeb. She's a reporter for ProPublica Illinois. We're talking about an investigative piece that she worked on with other journalists looking at a financial aid loophole that some families in Illinois are taking advantage of. And Dua, you said that you looked specifically or primarily at Lake County, Illinois. How widespread was that in what is quite a small sample there?
Yeah, so we found, and as you mentioned, you know, I helped out my colleagues Jody Cohen and Melissa Sanchez on this, and basically found almost four dozen families in Lake County who were doing this. Since then, we've looked at McHenry County, and we found about 10 cases there that appear to follow the same pattern, and this is all just within the last year and a half. And so from what we can tell, it's happening. And we think that a lot of these families have gone to the same college consultant, and that this was something that we're hearing was advised by her.
And there is a good chance that this is happening in other parts of the country as well. It's just that you are based in Illinois and that's where you started your investigation.
Exactly, exactly. We are a nonprofit independent newsroom based in Chicago, and we focus on Illinois. So we kind of started from there, and we're slowly working our way out, and we're still investigating.
We were talking about the needs-based financial aid, and you were saying this isn't illegal. Some people are saying, you know, these families are going to have a hard time paying for college, but is there enough of this financial aid to go around for people who might be in much tighter financial situations than the families that took advantage of this loophole?
Well, I think that's why this story has really struck a nerve, because the pool of financial aid is finite. I mean, once one student gets it, that means another student can't. So last year in Illinois, there were more than 80,000 students who had qualified for that MAP grant and couldn't get it because the state ran out of money. It's a first-come, first-served basis scholarship or grant. And so because other students got it, then other students who still needed it weren't able to get it. So I think that's why people are really angry about this.
Students who took advantage of this loophole were applying to a variety of universities and colleges, including big state universities like University of Illinois and UW-Madison, also smaller private colleges. Have you heard in the wake of your investigation, are the schools stepping up to try to identify when this might be the case in an application?
Yes, we have reached out to a number of universities, including the ones you mentioned, including UW-Madison. And what we've heard from them is they're looking at this, and that if they find that the students misrepresented their financial need, if they find that they were still being supported by their family financially, or they're still on their medical insurance, then they are going to pull back the institutional financial aid that they were given. You know, they made sure to say that they are still required to give out the state and federal aid, but the university aid that they have power over, that is something that they will reduce. And actually, University of Illinois, where this kind of they all started in terms of being able to recognize that this was a problem, has already done so with three students.
Dua, since this reporting came out, the U.S. Department of Education and the state of Illinois have also responded. What has their reaction been?
So the U.S. Department of Education Office of Inspector General has said they want to add clarifying language to the financial aid forms, the federal financial aid form, which is really where all of this begins, and basically saying, again, if the students are receiving medical financial support from their parents, then they would not be qualified to get this aid. In Illinois, lawmakers are also very upset. They have, actually, we just heard yesterday that they have scheduled a hearing for next week where they are demanding answers. One legislator that I talked to said that they are looking to see whether or not they can have the power to subpoena parents to testify at the hearing. And again, I think this, you know, it's twofold. You know, one, it's like, well, are these parents really cash strapped? Is this really kind of a last resort for them? And is it because college has gotten so expensive that even middle-class families can't afford it? Or is this about parents who can genuinely afford to pay for college and are using the system to get out of it?
And Dua, before we let you go, what are you and your colleagues going to be looking for as this story goes forward?
So we continue reporting. We want to see how widespread it is. We want to hear from parents and families about, again, why this is happening, why they did this, if this is happening in other places, to what extent. I mean, we have so many questions, and we're just going to keep investigating.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your research with us. And I am guessing that there will be an update coming soon.
Thank you so much for having me on to discuss it.
Dua Aldib is a reporter for ProPublica Illinois. She joined us to talk about parents giving up custody of their kids so that they'll qualify for need-based financial aid going into college. You can read more about the story, the initial story, and a follow-up at ProPublica.org. You can also share your experiences. Here on Central Time, we love to talk about the many things and people that make Wisconsin unique and wonderful. And some of the conversations we most enjoy bringing to you are those that feature amazing young people in our state. So we're asking you to tell us about the kids in your community who stand out so we can talk with them and share their stories more widely. Do you know of a young person, high school aged or younger, who makes the world around them a better place? Maybe they're doing great volunteer work, or maybe they've inspired those around them to do better. Maybe they're a great ambassador for their sport, their hobby, or their community. You can email us their name and where they live at centraltime@wpr.org. Tell us what makes them special, and if you have a good idea of how we can connect with them through their parents, that would be great too. Again, that email address is centraltime@wpr.org. We're looking forward to hearing about them. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about why state health officials think vaping may be related to the hospitalization of 11 young people across Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.